Few people would volunteer for every possible group. Most are likely to have special interests, such as postal services, art, manufacture of building materials, and services for the disabled. They could volunteer to serve on the relevant groups and also make submissions to the groups, comment on policies, and in other ways organize to promote their favored policies. Demarchy solves the problem of participation in a neat fashion. Recognizing that it is impossible for everyone to participate on every issue in an informed fashion, it avoids anything resembling a governing body, which makes far-reaching decisions on a range of issues. Instead, the functional groups have a limited domain. The people who care most about a particular issue can seek to have an influence over policy in that area. They can leave other issues to other groups and the people most concerned about them. This is basically a process of decentralization of decision-making by topic or function, rather than by geography or numbers. Leaving decision-making to those who care most about a topic has its dangers, of course. Self-interested cliques can obtain power and exclude others. This is what happens normally in all sorts of organizations, from governments and corporations to social movement groups. Demarchy handles this problem through the requirement of random selection. No one can be guaranteed a formal decision-making role. Furthermore, the terms of service are strictly limited, so no permanent executive or clique can develop. Another problem then looms. Won't there be biases in the groups selected because only certain sorts of people will volunteer? Won't most of the groups, for example, be dominated by white middle-aged men? This poses no problem given a suitable adaptation of how the random selection is carried out. Suppose, for example, that 80 men and 20 women volunteer for a group of 10, for which it is desired to have an equal number of men and women. The method is simply to select 5 men randomly from the 80 male volunteers and 5 women from the 20 female volunteers. In this way, the sex balance in the group can equal that in the overall population, even with different rates of volunteering. The same principle can be applied to characteristics such as ethnic origin, social class, age, occupation, and religion. This may sound logical enough, but who is to make the decisions about what groups are represented in what ways? After all, if a group decides on its own criteria for selection, this is open to abuse. Bernheim's solution to this is what he calls second-order groups. These are groups which act analogously to a judicial system for the operation of demarchy. The second-order groups deal only with procedural issues, such as what first-order groups should exist, how the random selection should be carried out, and any other disputed point. Obviously, members of the second-order groups should have had experience in the first-order groups. How should they be selected? Bernheim suggests that first-order groups should select from among their members those most suitable for second-order groups. Bob James argued to me that this really goes against the guiding principle of demarchy, which is random selection of interested people, rather than selection on the basis of performance or popularity. He suggests that second-order group members be chosen randomly from first-order group members. My guess is that the differences between these two procedures would not be so great. Even with a random selection, it is likely that members seen to be performing well would be strongly encouraged by their colleagues to stand for second-order group membership, which would probably not be all that sought after anyway. Finally, the limited term of office on the second-order groups will prevent entrenchment of power. Several features distinguish demarchy from representative democracy, including random selection, functional groups, limited tenure of office, and elimination of the state and bureaucracy. Some of these could serve as reforms to representative democracy, but there is also a coherency in the entire package. For example, a limited term of office, say 2 years, would help prevent entrenchment of power in representative systems. Why should demarchy be better able to sustain such a requirement for turnover of members of decision-making groups? One difference lies in the legitimacy attached to the selection principle. Representatives justify their position in terms of repeated majority preference for their personal selection. Randomly selected individuals have no special legitimation except the random process itself. The legitimacy of random selection lies in regular replacement rather than popular mandate or acquired experience. And this type of legitimacy more easily allows challenges should those in office attempt to extend their term. A similar difference can be seen in the often lengthy tenure of judges, whether appointed or elected, compared to jurors. There is not the space here to go into many of the issues raised by the concept of demarchy. Suffice it to say that there are many unanswered questions and many areas where further elaboration is required. I'll mention only a few here. First, implementation of decisions. Bernheim has rejected the state and bureaucracy, so there won't be any permanent staff to carry out decisions made by the demarchic groups. Bernheim says that the groups will carry out the decisions themselves. That sounds fine in theory, but what will it mean in practice? Second, how will decisions be enforced? Remember, there is no state and hence no military. Essentially, decisions will be effective if people abide by them, and this depends on the overall legitimacy of the system. Actually, this isn't too different from many aspects of present society. Most people accept the need to act in a sensible manner toward babies, public parks, and for that matter, private property, even when the possibility of legal sanctions and apprehension by the police is remote. Force plays only a limited role in the routine operation of society. In a more participatory society, force could play an even more limited role. The corollary of this is that unpopular decisions by demarchic groups would simply lapse through non-observance. The groups would have to take into account the willingness of the population to accept their decisions. Without the state, there would be no military. How would a community defend itself against external aggression? One possibility is arming the people. However, the most participatory alternative to military defense is social defense, based on popular nonviolent resistance. Demarchy and social defense have many compatible features. Third, a big unanswered question is the nature of the economic system associated with demarchy. In principle, a range of systems are compatible with demarchic decision-making. A group could make a contract for recycling services either with a privately owned company or with a self-managed collective. Demarchy, though, is not compatible with bureaucratically organized economic systems, either socialist or capitalist. Bernheim argues for extension of the principles of demarchy to economics. For example, there would be demarchic groups to make decisions about particular areas of land. Rents could be charged for uses of the land, and the rents would take the place of taxation, since there is no state to collect taxes. This is an adaptation of Henry George's ideas. The random selection for groups making decisions over portions of land would prevent vested interests from gaining a stranglehold over the political economic process. Bernheim would also extend this idea to control over labor and money as well as land. These ideas are in a very preliminary form. One other important problem is the basic one of participation. What if people don't volunteer? What if certain groups don't produce enough volunteers for their quota? In some cases, this would be a sign of success. If the way things are operating is acceptable to most people, then there would be no urgency about becoming a member of a decision-making group. By contrast, in controversial areas, participation is not likely to be a problem. If topics such as abortion or genetic engineering generated passionate debate, then concerned individuals and groups would find it fruitful to educate as many people as possible about the issues and encourage them to stand for random selection. Indeed, any unpopular decision could generate a mobilization of people to stand for selection. Furthermore, the people mobilized would have to span a range of categories, men and women, young and old, etc. As a result, participation and informed comment would be highest in the areas of most concern. In other areas, people would be happy to let others look after matters. It would be easy to carry on at length about the hypothetical features of demarchy, but what's the point if it's all just a vision? Bernheim has given the most eloquent expression of demarchy, but he is far from the only person with these sorts of ideas. Random selection, after all, has been around at least since the ancient Greeks, and it should not be surprising that advocates emerge now and again. Bernheim's vision is a very decentralized and participatory use of random selection. By contrast, others have advocated random selection for the U.S. Congress, for example, replacing the elected House of Representatives by a randomly selected representative house. These proposals have many merits, but leave intact the power of the state. Of special interest are those who have tried out random selection in practice. One such person is Ned Crosby, a political scientist from Minnesota in the United States. In the 1970s, Crosby developed his own idea of a political alternative involving random selection, with a much more centralized system than Bernheim. But failing to find a publisher for his book, he decided to work on practical implementation. Crosby set up an organization which is now called the Jefferson Center for New Democratic Processes. It has devoted most of its energy toward practical experiments in random selection for policymaking. One project concerned the question of whether to introduce school-based clinics to deal with teenage pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases, a very contentious issue in the state. The Jefferson Center convened a number of groups of randomly selected people, which they call policy juries. A 12-person policy jury was organized for each of the 8 congressional districts in the state of Minnesota. Using the telephone directory, 100 people in each district were selected randomly and contacted and surveyed about their basic views concerning school-based clinics. Then a jury pool was set up from those contacted by ensuring that the demographic characteristics, ethnic origin, sex, social class, of those in the pool matched those in the overall population. Then people from each pool were selected randomly and invited to be policy jurors until 12 jurors were obtained. In this process, it was ensured that the preliminary views about school-based clinics of the jurors matched the percentages found in the overall survey. Thus, the resulting policy juries very nearly matched the overall population in both demographic characteristics and in preliminary views on school-based clinics. I'm reading from Democracy Without Elections by Brian Martin. The policy jury in each district held hearings. They listened to various experts, heard testimony from partisans on each side of the issue, and discussed the issue among themselves. At the end of 4 days of deliberation, each policy jury took a vote concerning various policy alternatives. As well, each jury gave reasons for its views, made additional policy recommendations, and evaluated the experience of the policy jury itself. In addition to the 8 district-based policy juries, a statewide policy jury of 24 people was set up with 3 members from each district jury. The statewide jury went through a similar process. The recommendation of the policy juries were made available to Minnesota state legislatures and also widely publicized in the media. Through all this, the Jefferson Center provided the essential support for the process. It carried out the surveys, the random selection, convening of the juries, arranging for expert witnesses, coordination of the jury deliberations, and writing up and publicizing of the recommendations. To carry weight, it was essential that the Jefferson Center be perceived as committed to a fair process, not to any partisan view on the issue being discussed. In the above description, I've given only the basic outline of the process. There are many more details for those interested. The basic question to be asked is, how well did it work? In terms of democratic processes, the answer must be remarkably well. The key test here is the response of the jurors themselves. They quickly became very committed to the process, taking it extremely seriously. They demonstrated a good grasp of the issues and made sensible recommendations. They also evaluated the process very positively. From the outside, the policy juries were also well received. They were given favorable reviews by the media and taken seriously by politicians, who recognized the grassroots origin of the views expressed. The Jefferson Center has had similar experiences and success with policy juries on topics such as pollution of water supplies by agricultural chemicals. Policy juries are not the equivalent of the decision-making groups in demarchy. Policy juries have no formal power, which remains with elected representatives. The policy juries can only influence policy on the basis of the persuasiveness of their views and the process which led to them. But then, in one sense, this would not be so entirely different from demarchic bodies, which would gain most of their power from community acceptance. There are several lessons for promoting demarchy from the Jefferson Center projects. First, random selection can be seen as a legitimate basis for a process leading to policy recommendations. Second, participants become strongly involved in the decision-making process. Policy juries are practical experiences in participation, which may whet the appetite for more. Third, extensive and careful planning is essential to the success of policy juries. It should be remembered that enormous preparation and energy is put into making elections work in legitimizing certain policy process. To be fairly judged, the same preparation and energy must be devoted to demarchic alternatives. Finally, policy juries represent a practical intermediate stage for advocates of demarchy. Crosby sees random selection as a means for reforming and revitalizing democracy in the United States, making government truly responsive to the will of the people. Demarchy, as presented here, is a more fundamental restructuring of society, eliminating the state altogether. This difference in goals need not cause any special problem. After all, there is a great need for practical steps which are valuable in themselves, but also the basis for more fundamental change. Cooperatives can be an experience and a step towards an economy based on production for use rather than profit or control. Similarly, policy juries can be an experience and a step towards demarchy. Quite independently of the Jefferson Center, similar projects were being undertaken in West Germany beginning in the 1970s, led by Peter Dinell at the University of Wuppertal. The groups of randomly selected citizens brought together for these projects are called planning cells. The cells have dealt with issues such as energy policy, town planning, and information technology. The cell members are typically brought together for 4 days of talks, discussions, and evaluations, and are compensated for wages foregone. Planning cells have many similarities to policy juries. Here I'll just mention a few highlights, focusing especially on the differences. First, the planning cells have usually been given wider briefs. Rather than focus on particular policy options on a well-defined issue such as school-based clinics, a broader range of scenarios is dealt with. For example, in looking at energy policy, several options were canvassed, ranging from a heavily nuclear future to a soft energy path based on energy efficiency and renewable energy technologies. These widely divergent futures are part of a conventional political debate, to be sure, but seldom are they confronted in direct fashion in the normal course of policy making, which deals for the most part with the issues in terms of particular urgent decisions on particular projects, a waste disposal site, a regulatory decision, a funding decision. Planning cells are able to deal with broad social issues and take a long-term view, certainly far longer than the typical politician concerned about the next election. Second, the planning cells make more use of small group techniques. Much of the time of members in a 25-person planning cell is spent in groups of five discussing the issues. Whereas the policy jury seems to be modeled on an actual jury, hearing testimony and discussing the issue in the full group, the planning cells are somewhat more oriented to mutual support and building up the participation and understanding of the cell members. But these differences are minor compared to the major similarities. Random selection of group members to deal with policy issues. The striking result is that most of the randomly selected volunteers quickly become quite knowledgeable about the subject matter and committed to the decision-making process. And I'm reading from Democracy Without Elections by Brian Martin. Towards Demarchy. Between the few experiments with policy juries and planning cells, and Bernheim's vision of demarchy is an enormous gulf. What strategy should be used to move towards demarchy? Bernheim has some ideas. He thinks that as various government bodies become discredited, they may be willing to switch to demarchic management in order to maintain community legitimacy. For example, a health service might be racked by disputes over salaries, conflict over provision of high-technology medicine or community support services, severe budgetary crisis, and claims of mismanagement and corruption. This wouldn't be unusual. In this crisis situation, management by randomly selected groups might be seen by state managers as a way of resolving or offloading conflict and re-legitimating the health service. These and other similar scenarios may sound plausible, but they really provide little guidance for action. After all, there are plenty of unpopular, discredited, and corrupt institutions in society, but this has seldom led to significant changes in the method of social decision-making. More specifically, how should demarchy be promoted in these situations? By lobbying state managers? By raising the idea among the general population? One thing is clear. The idea of demarchy must become much more well-known before there is the slightest chance of implementation. The experimentation with policy juries and planning cells is vital in gaining experience and spreading the idea of participation through random selection. The limitation of these approaches is that they are not linked to major social groups which would be able to mobilize people to work for the alternative. Amongst the major social groups in society, quite a number are likely to be hostile to demarchy. This includes most of the powerful groups, such as governments, corporate managements, trade union leaders, political parties, militaries, professions, etc. Genuine popular participation, after all, threatens the prerogatives of elites. In my opinion, the most promising source of support is social movements, peace activists, feminists, environmentalists, etc. Groups such as these have an interest in wider participation, which is more likely to promote their goals than the present power elites. Social movement groups can try to put demarchy on the agenda by the use of study groups, lobbying, leafleting, and grassroots organizing. Demarchy, though, should not only be seen as a policy issue, as a measure to be implemented in the community as a result of grassroots pressure. Demarchy can also be used by social movements as a means. In other words, they can use it for their own decision-making. This may not sound like much of a difficulty. After all, many social action groups already use consensus either formally or de facto. Also, the system of delegates is quite common. It would not seem a great shift to use random selection for decision-making at scales where direct consensus becomes difficult to manage. Unfortunately, matters in many social movements are hardly this ordered. In many cases, formal bureaucratic systems have developed, especially in the large national organizations, and there are quite a number of experienced and sometimes charismatic individuals in powerful positions. These individuals are possibly as unlikely as any politician to support conversion to a different system of decision-making. This itself is probably as good a recommendation for random selection as could be obtained. Any proposal that threatens elites in alternative as well as mainstream organizations must have something going for it. Nevertheless, social movements must be one of the more promising places to promote demarchy. If they can actually begin to try out the methods, they can become much more effective advocates. Furthermore, the full vision of demarchy without state or bureaucracy stands a better chance within non-bureaucratized social movements than amid the ruins of bungled government enterprises. One of the most promising areas for promoting demarchy is in industry. Workers are confronted by powerful hierarchical systems on every side: corporate management, governments, and trade union bosses. There is plenty of experience in cooperative decision-making at the shop floor level. Difficulties arise at higher levels of decision-making. It is here that random selection presents itself as a real alternative. Works councils, composed of both workers and managers, selected randomly to serve a short period, provide a basis for communication and coordination. This approach overcomes the defects of all forms of representation. Workers' representatives on boards of management have served to co-opt workers, while representatives in the form of trade union delegates have often become separated from the shop floor. Demarchic groups provide a way to maintain shop floor involvement in large enterprises. The key point here is that demarchy should not be treated as a policy alternative to be implemented from the top, but rather as a method of action itself. The ends should be incorporated in the means. It is quite appropriate that groups promoting demarchy use its techniques. Needless to say, the future of demarchy cannot be mapped out. It is stimulating to speculate about solutions to anticipated problems. Bernheim's general formulations are immensely valuable in providing a vision. But as democracy by lot is tested, promoted, tried out, enjoys successes and suffers failures, it will be revised and refined. That is to be expected. The message is that the process of developing and trying out alternatives is essential for all those seeking a more participative society. True enough, some worthy reforms can be achieved through the old channels of electoral politics, but that is no excuse for neglecting the task of investigating new structures. Demarchy is one such alternative and deserves attention. Demarchy is unlikely to be the final word in participative politics. No doubt it has flaws, but it is certain that the present electoral methods provide no final solution. Electoral methods, that brings me back to the Greens. They may be one of the most exciting political developments in decades, but in entering electoral politics, they may have limited their potential for bringing about radical change. Ironically, it is the popular, charismatic Green politicians who provide least threat to established power structures. Their electoral success will ensure continuing reliance on the old system of politics. And I have been reading Democracy Without Elections, an article by Professor Brian Martin, published in the 1995-96 edition of Social Anarchism. Brian Martin is Associate Professor in Science, Technology, and Society at the University of Wollongong in New South Wales. I hope you enjoyed that article, and it's given you food for thought in the new year.
When we're living in the White House and debating on the Hill, of all your crazy antics, we'll all have had our fill. We'll be closing down munitions plants and Old Glory will be furled. 'Cause we don't want your big machines, we just want the world. And a bill will be proposed, section number one. We're shutting down the oil rigs and turning towards the sun. The air will be clean for all the boys and girls, 'cause we don't want your oil tankers, we just want the world. executioner. Shut the logging camps all down. Get busy planting hemp. Leave the trees there in the ground. Life is too precious on this little spinning pearl. 'Cause we don't want your bulldozers, we just want the world. We'll be closing down the jails and fixing up the schools, distributing those stocks and bonds, changing all the rules. We'll elect a CEO, maybe a rabbit or a squirrel. 'Cause we don't want your money, we just want the world. Be swimming in the rivers and running to the hills, reading in the history books of wars and oil spills. If it's linear, we'll bend it. If it's a straight line, it'll curl. 'Cause we don't want your dead-end highway, we just want the world. When we're living in the White House and debating on the Hill, of all your crazy antics, we'll all have had our fill. We'll be closing down munitions plants and Old Glory will be firm. 'Cause we don't want your big machines, we just want the world.
We conclude with an interview with Jeff Schmidt, recorded in 2005. By the People's Power Hour on WIDR in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
We are now honored to have Jeff Schmidt, physicist and social critic, author of Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at the Salaried Professionals and the Soul Battering System that Shaped Their Lives. Jeff was on the editorial staff of Physics Today for 19 years until he was fired for writing the book we'll be talking about today, which was a thought-provoking examination of the politics of education and employment. Mr. Schmidt has a PhD, we could call him Dr. Schmidt, in physics from the University of California, Irvine, and has taught in the United States, Central America, and Africa. Physics Today magazine, where Dr. Schmidt worked, is published by the American Institute of Physics, which is governed by the American Physical Society and other physics organizations. To date, nearly 1,000 people in a wide range of fields have condemned the American Institute of Physics for firing Dr. Schmidt over this book, and this includes more than 500 physicists, the largest number of physicists ever to speak out on a freedom of expression issue in the United States.
Dr. Schmidt, I was wondering if maybe we could start out, you could tell us a little bit about how this process all started, maybe as a graduate student at UC Irvine studying physics and the political climate you encountered there and how you dealt with that.
Certainly. When I arrived at the University of California, Irvine, to be a physics graduate student, I immediately encountered a bunch of stressed-out graduate students and a generally repressive atmosphere. I remember walking in and seeing one of the graduate students packing up his books because he had just been kicked out of physics graduate school because of this qualification examination they had given. So I laid low for a while until they passed me on that examination, and then I became more active politically. Actually, I had been active politically even when I was laying low, but I confined my activity to areas outside of the physics department. But once they passed me on that exam, I helped form a chapter of the Science for the People organization, which was a group that was questioning the largely military orientation of scientific research and so on. And we were very active in the department and on campus. For example, when the head of the Los Alamos Nuclear Weapons Laboratory was brought to the department to speak, we confronted him and asked him why he had lobbied in favor of the neutron bomb. And this was very embarrassing for his hosts who were, you know, who had their ideas of how you treat the head of a national laboratory. You don't ask probing questions like that.
So
but, they finally did give me my degree, in part to get rid of me, and then I went to work at Physics Today magazine. I had been in the working world before physics graduate school, and getting back into it at Physics Today really reminded me of what bothered me about the whole work situation. Basically, I wrote this book, Disciplined Minds, because I got fed up with ass-kissers at work. I hope you're allowed to use that word on your radio program. especially the well-educated ones, the salaried professionals. These were people who would never express an opinion that might displease people above them in the workplace hierarchy. No matter what the issue, you could count on that. And later I realized that the bosses did count on that. They expected their professionals to be politically subordinate experts, not independent thinkers. Fortunately, on most jobs, I found a tiny minority of independent thinkers in this vast sea of spineless intellectual workers. And I discovered that these intellectually and politically subordinate individuals are deliberately produced. That's what my graduate school experience taught me. I had wondered, where do these people come from? And then when I went to graduate school, I saw where they come from. They're deliberately produced, and that was a big motivation for me to write this book. My own training was in science, and I saw the best of my fellow graduate students being kicked out of the program or dropping out on their own, having read the writing on the wall. Those were the students who were the most concerned about other people and about society seemed to be the most likely to disappear. The system favored self-centered, narrowly focused students.
So can you talk to us a bit about the relationship between science and the military?
Well, my own field, physics, is closely tied to the military. It's almost 100% tied to the federal government. Almost 100% of physics research in the United States is federally funded, even at the university level, through contracts and grants. And there's a whole military atmosphere in physics departments. I remember one day our Science for the People organization brought a speaker to the physics department for a lunch meeting. This was a science and society seminar we had started, and the speaker was from a different department, sociology, and I think we entered the building. I walked him over from sociology to the physics building, and as we entered the building, there was a clock there that said 12:01, and he looked up at the clock, and he said, "Oh, we're on time." And I said, "No, we're 1 minute late." And this illustrated the difference between the cultures of sociology and physics. And he ended up using this as an example in his talk, which really upset some of the physicists who didn't like to be likened to the military culture.
Dr. Schmidt, when exactly were you in graduate school?
Well, this was in the 1970s.
So in a time of, you know, social upheaval and a lot of criticism to the government and a lot of that issuing from university campuses, is it in your opinion, do you think has the climate on university campuses changed? We've talked with a lot of academics and talked about a lot of academics that are currently having a lot of issues. I mean, Ward Churchill being one. We spoke with, help me with his
David
name.
Graeber.
David Graeber, who was under, you know, disciplinary action at Yale because of his political beliefs. I mean, is this something that's being stepped up on campuses?
Well, I don't think it's being stepped up, but the resistance to it has been decreasing. I think that's what happened. And David Graeber is not fortunate enough to be under disciplinary procedures at Yale. I think they just fired him without any procedures at all. And the problem is the lack of resistance to that kind of repression. That repression is common, and it's something we expect in a hierarchical system, right? But what really upsets us is the lack of resistance to it.
Mm-hmm. I was curious. You talked about how graduate school, you know, effectively shapes conformists as opposed to critical thinkers. What role do examinations play in that? That's something you write about quite a bit in your book.
Yeah, I spend more than one chapter on examinations, in particular this qualification examination, which all graduate students have to pass to be allowed to go on to get their Ph.D. There's a lot of weeding and transformation that happens around examinations, and I use the qualification exam as an example, but really all exams share a lot of these same characteristics. These big exams, these big high-stakes exams, terrorize the student with the threat of expulsion. The process of preparing for these tests, because of the kind of questions on the tests and the way they have to be answered, really alienates the students from the subjects that they went into because of love of these subjects. The tests emphasize quick recall, memorize tricks, mathematical tricks, work on detached problems, separated from their social origin, work under time pressure, sheer endurance, quantitative results, comfort with confinement to details, comfort with the whole social framework of the test and course and institution, comfort with the hierarchical division of labor because tests usually emphasize theory over experiment, at least in the sciences. The tests de-emphasize qualitative discussion, physical insight, exploration, curiosity, creativity, history, philosophy, and so on. And this forces the student who wants to be passed to adopt an instrumental view of the subject, to basically view the subject as a tool, to use it in a way that's not intrinsically satisfying in an alienated way. And that is not an accident. That's good preparation for most employment. Because employers don't want philosophers or critics. They want people who can churn out the work and not be distracted by their own thoughts about it.
That's interesting because, you know, many scientists, I think of themselves as self-directed, kind of autonomous researchers, don't they?
They certainly do, and they try to maintain that self-image. It's very important to them. But they're not really self-directed at all. In my book, I describe how the military funding agencies, such as the Air Force Office of Scientific Research, the Navy and the Army Offices of Scientific Research, how they direct the curiosity of physics researchers by making money available in certain areas. If the Army Research Office, for example, makes $10 million available in a particular area of physics, a lot of physicists will find, well, gee, I am interested in that. That's kind of interesting. And they'll send in their grant applications. So their curiosity is directed, but it's directed in a way that allows them to think that they are self-directed.
Well, and this is also something that we're seeing mirrored in the workplace, a lot of emphasis on people no longer are employees. They're associates and things like that. Some sort of like the vestiges of self-management being put out there to employees. Is that also being done in the in graduate schools and the academic world?
Well, I think they've done that all along. In the academic world, that pretense. I know about the associates and the partners at various companies. It seems like the more their work is standardized and made into a formula, the more the employer has to give them some kind of indication that they're really independent and self-directed.
If in name alone, right?
I was curious, so what are some of the resistance strategies? I found it was interesting in your book you actually refer people that are working within professional organizations to check out Field Manual 21-78, Prisoner of War Resistance, put out by the U.S. Army.
Yes, that's right. That's both serious and humorous at the same time. What happened was my interviews with students led me to the strange idea that cult indoctrination might shed light on professional training and graduate school, because many of the students' experiences in graduate school sounded like what goes on in organizations that are accused of brainwashing, so-called brainwashing their members into unthinking clones. So I looked into the techniques that totalitarian organizations use to get people to play a politically subordinate role. And I found that professional training programs use the same techniques. These include, for example, recruitment through big promises, social isolation through milieu control, setting up teachers as unquestioned authority, undermining true self-confidence, and a gross exaggeration of the importance of the work to the world. And after seeing that similarity to cult indoctrination, I thought, well, how can this be resisted? And that's when I discovered this Army manual called Prisoner of War Resistance, in which the Army trains its people how to resist indoctrination if they are captured and made prisoners of war. And I found that these techniques applied very well to graduate school and the workplace and any hierarchical repressive situation. So I wrote in my book that the United States Army issued a survival manual for graduate school without knowing it. And in fact, in a crucial way, the military manual is better than civilian advice books, which are written specifically for students. These civilian books help you conform to the demands of the institution. You get your credential, but you lose your identity in the process. However, the Army manual shows you how to survive the training program and keep control over your identity. That the military even has a name for it. They call it honorable survival. And we need more honorable survival in our educational institutions.
You know, this show has done a number of... We used to do a yearly workplace sabotage, workplace resistance show. And in researching those shows, you know, there are a number of corporations and businesses set up to defuse workplace tension and defuse, you know, people who would sabotage workplaces. You mentioned that, you know, resistance to this hierarchy is being reduced. Is it, you know, is it being reduced, or has it gone more underground? Are people more quiet about it, individualistic about it, rather than kind of the large group type resistance that we see in, you know, in the labor history, et cetera?
Well, people are still dissatisfied, but they're seeking individual solutions, and there isn't much sabotage or whatever going on because people feel weak and isolated. There's really no substitute for organization. But people are tremendously dissatisfied, and from time to time they do some things that you might call sabotage that just reduce the productivity of the place. This is pretty well documented in the Dilbert comic strip. But I would say there's no substitute for organizing, mm-hmm. and there's less organizing now. The formal organizing, which is unionization, is down way low. I think 7 out of 8 workers are not in unions at this time.
It's interesting, though. We're talking about graduate school and union organizing, and of course, graduate students have been organizing unions. What potential do you see there?
That's great. I think that's a good first step, and I would like to see those unions go beyond wages and working conditions and talk about the actual content of the graduate programs and stand up for the rights of the students in disputes that arise over the actual content of the training. This is what the universities feared in the graduate organizing. They feared that it would lead to that, and I hope it does lead to that.
Speaking of resistance strategies, you list a number of them, several pages worth, towards the end of your book. And just to give one example, you suggest to, quote, blow the whistle and sabotage projects that are against the public interest. You act as a radical professional for a fair social structure, even at your employer's expense. You do this, for example, by leaking plans and other information to opposition organizations or to the press. In the case of the press, you make it the radical press, not only to avoid an innocuous treatment of the issue, but also to build the radical press. When this activity becomes widespread, all segments of society will see the radical press as required reading. I was wondering, were a number of these survival strategies for radicals finding themselves working in the professions, did this have something to do with Physics Today taking the action that it did?
Well, actually, yeah, in the book I list 33 suggestions of things you can do on the job to further your own agenda, which I think you have a moral right to do, and I can explain why I think that in a minute. But, yes, I tried out, over the 19 years I was there, I tried out most of these 33 techniques and didn't get fired. They fired me when I published the list. So you don't have to publish the list. However, you do take a risk in doing these things, but I argue that you take a much bigger risk by not resisting, because at stake is your is not just the nature of the workplace and society, but your own nature as well, your very identity. And if you conform, you're losing control of your identity. The system of education and employment works to define or redefine who you are in the deepest sense, pushing you away from developing and acting on your own vision and guiding ideas. So if you want to stand for something and avoid vanishing as an independent force in society, you really have no choice but to become an activist and resist. And, yes, resisting the system carries some risk, but I think not resisting is a far deadlier course for your individual identity.
And we are talking to Dr. Jeff Schmidt, author of Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives. Anyone interested in checking out more about this book and Dr. Schmidt can look at www.disciplinedminds.com.
Dr. Schmidt, you've had a number of people, including 1,000 physicists, come to your side in this struggle that you have been embroiled in. I mean, including Noam Chomsky and other noted people. What's the, you know, from the physicist community and the we've seen a lot of outpouring of support for you. What's been the support outside of the academic and scientific communities?
Well, it's been pretty good. Actually, there's more support outside of the highly educated community. These highly educated people, as I explain in the book, tend to be conservative and not to speak out. Nevertheless, 500 physicists have spoken out, in part because they thought that my firing hurt them by tarnishing the image of physics. Remember, they have this image of physics as being this institution where people freely pursue their ideas, there's free debate and so on. So when physics institutions act like repressive institutions in other fields, this upsets physicists and physicists who want to think that physics is better in those areas. But outside of the highly educated people, there's been a lot of support among those who have found out about my dismissal. Of course, most people haven't heard anything about this at all.
Well, and is that because you think it's outside of their kind of realm of what they're looking at? I mean, this has definitely not been something that's been covered on or has it been, on NPR or other major news sources?
No, it hasn't been covered.
So unless you're looking for this, it's hard to find. But that's really that's troubling to me because here in Kalamazoo, Pat Buchanan came to speak, and at the end of his talk, someone doused him with salad dressing, and that was a huge uproar. That was in all the news. CNN, everyone was carrying it as some sort of horrific wet blanket over free speech. But issues like yours, Ward Churchill's, and others, other academics who are being from the left, especially, who are being charged with speaking out, that is not making the news.
And the real lack of free speech is the lack of free speech at the place where people have their greatest interaction with society, which is on the job.
Mm-hmm.
You essentially check your free speech rights when you walk into the workplace. Here in Washington, D.C., you can literally see free speech rights being cut back. For example, a couple years ago, police surrounded an entire anti-World Bank rally and arrested everybody there. They arrested 650 people. They arrested the entire rally. And based on the theory that the intent of the group, as the police chief said, was to disrupt the city, which is illegal, he said. There was very little outrage against that. There was a court case which is proceeding, but as far as public outrage at the violation of free speech, not much. And I think there's a reason for that. It's because very few people ever exercise their right of free expression, and so losing the right is no big deal to them. Most people go their entire lives without ever speaking out in a way that would get them into trouble if the First Amendment wasn't there to protect them. Activists are really the only people who truly understand these things, so we need to get more people to become activists.
So it's interesting you just mentioned the World Bank. I was curious how institutions like that play a role in exporting to the world this Western style of professionalization, which does so much to keep people from becoming activists, and that, it sort of indoctrinates them in quite the opposite direction.
I don't know that much about the World Bank, but there's a good example of what you just said within the bank itself. The staff of the World Bank is very, very liberal. They're very much opposed to the war in Iraq, for example. And now we have a new head of the World Bank who is an architect of the war in Iraq. You might think this would cause a big problem, but it will not cause a big problem. Those professionals will check their own ideas at the door, and they will carry out Wolfowitz's policies as good professionals. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I call upon professionals to pursue their own ideology and their own goals, own vision.
I was just wondering how this all might fit into this, this rhetoric we always hear of development, in that, if perhaps the problems of the third world result from a shortage of, the proper style of education or what have you.
Yeah, the World Bank does play a big role in world education, and they have a model that's pretty much the American model. They want to replace people who staff governments in other countries with bureaucrats who score well on tests, people who have no vision of their own but who are good at following a vision that's dictated by the person at the top. And so they're introducing these kinds of exams around the world.
This has been Dr. Jeff Schmidt, the author of Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul battering system that shapes their lives. For more information, see him on the web at Disciplined Minds. That's one word, disciplinedminds.com. Once again, Dr. Schmidt, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
And thanks to the People's Power Hour of WIDR, Kalamazoo, Michigan, for that interview. You can find them on the web at myspace.com/People's Power Hour. For Brian Martin, he's got a long URL. The best way is to Google Brian Martin in quotes. That's Brian, B-R-I-A-N. And our website is unwelcomeguest.org, where you can download this and previous shows from the MP3 archive. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco. Thanks for listening, and have a hell-raising 2007.